It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. Jeff Stein can't be with us today, but we've got a really interesting show that we've talked a lot in recent weeks about the 9/11 case in New York, brought by the families against the Saudi government, the ruling by the federal judge that gave a green light for this lawsuit to move forward more than 20 years after it was filed, based on a lot of new evidence that has come out just over the last year or so. And that new evidence has been got an additional boost just in the last week and a half from two journalists in the UK who, in the Sunday Times of London, had a bombshell article revealed after 24 years how UK was forced to free 9/11 plotter. That plotter is a Saudi suspect by the name of Omar Bayoumi, who is believed by the families bringing the lawsuit to be the chief honcho of an entire Saudi support network for the 9/11 hijackers, something that was missed by the FBI originally, missed by the 9/11 Commission, but is only now coming to light. Those two reporters, Liz Harris and Amardeep Bassi, will be with us in a moment. But Karen, before we go there, let's just take a look at some of the big stories of the week in the Intel national security space. I guess we would want to start with that extraordinary hearing before Senate Judiciary on Wednesday with Kash Patel, the director of the FBI.
Yeah, it was quite an encounter. I mean, remember, this is something that is supposed to happen twice a year, where the FBI director comes in and talks to senators about what's happening at the FBI and answers questions. This really was, on the one hand, quite dramatic. It was, there were so many emotions at play. A lot of it seemed very performative. In other words, what speeches could be made. But what was very clear was that this is such a divided body, and that whatever issues they were going to get to the facts of were going to be hidden in the sort of rhetoric surrounding everything. So it was kind of a disappointing in terms of thinking, can Congress come together and talk about issues in a way that can move the ball forward?
I think we've long since passed that point.
Well, I'm forever hopeful. But there were four things I think that came out of it that I think
four. Are interesting. Okay.
Well, you know, you can knock me down to two.
You're
as we
so
go along.
Methodical, but go ahead, Karen, please.
You know, I could, you know. Yeah, well, yeah. Okay. So one was the persistent theme, which is actually rather important legally and normatively, of what exactly is the state of communications between the White House and the Department of Justice. And so the question would ask, and a number of times, just what kind of, were you directed by the White House to do things? Are you in contact with the White House? What is that relationship? And Director Patel sort of, you know, didn't quite answer it in a way that was, no, we're completely independent. He didn't go that far at all. But there was no really, you know, bottom line answer that he recognized that there was a longstanding policy of norms, that there is usually some kind of document drafted by the Department of Justice about the communications that will go on with the White House. I mean, he just sort of, you know, avoided the question in terms of coming to a secure answer. The second thing, and this was something that Cory Booker really emphasized, was the dismantling of the department and whether or not that had some impact on things like the investigation of Charlie Kirk, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and a number of other things. And what does this mean? And we know there are lawsuits out there now from Brian Driscoll and others who have been summarily relieved of their positions, suing the government for wrongful dismissal. So I thought that was interesting. Another thing sort of playing off of my early remark was just a lot about the Charlie Kirk investigation kept coming up in terms of praise for the FBI, in terms of what they did comments repeatedly by Kash Patel himself about the investigation and how it happened and how the FBI had performed.
Yeah,
and,
but what about the fact that he like announces on social media they had a suspect when in fact that suspect was not the guy who did it and they had to let him go? That is pretty unorthodox, to say the least, for an FBI director to be giving running commentary on an ongoing investigation.
But it is part of this administration to use social media. That's their default. That's what they like. And so,
but you'd like to think they get it right when they go on social media, despite all the evidence to the contrary. Right?
On the other hand, they did let somebody go who was a suspect. So that's also, you know, they...
Well, that's what we're going to be talking about on this show.
Yeah, right.
a actual FBI screw up of monumental proportions.
Yeah. From the past. And then the issue of Epstein, which kept coming up in its own way during the hearing. You know, what about the Epstein files and what about the Epstein case? And I thought that was actually very interesting. It was sort of how many hot button issues can you produce in one session? And I thought it was very interesting about Epstein and this sort of statement put forward that, and you could talk more about this, about the fact that Epstein was it luring other people into this, or what was the
No, no. Actually, I thought this was the biggest single piece of news out of that hearing. Strip away all the shouting and, you know, the name calling by Patel and the Democrats going after each other full throttle. When he's asked about the Epstein files and why he has not released the Epstein files, he said there is no credible information that Epstein trafficked women, girls to anybody other than himself. Now, we have not heard that before. And it does, I mean, if that is true, it does raise questions about why are we having all this big commotion about Epstein files.
Right.
And I've always thought it was ridiculous to begin with, the commotion over this, because the fact is there's a Justice Department manual that's been there for many years that says you don't release information about uncharged third parties. You don't like spill out into the public, you know, allegations that have not been corroborated, that do not lead to criminal charges. So just because somebody alleges that, you know, whoever did something awful, yet if it doesn't lead to criminal charges, you don't put that into the public sphere. It's why in indictments, when you see indictments, it says individual one or organization two, whatever, but you don't put the names of people out there. And I, you know, to me, the biggest greatest hypocrisy of all is by the Democrats, people like Jamie Raskin, civil libertarian constitutional law professor demanding release of files of uncorroborated charges against third parties. I mean, come on. This is all nonsense. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about here today. We are talking about the just to finish up on the FBI. Yeah, that whole Senate Judiciary hearing was kind of ridiculous. I thought it was just, you know, totally performative. It's the Senate Judiciary becoming like the House Judiciary, which is everybody just gets their 5 minutes to try to get a YouTube clip that they can use for fundraising purposes and get on TV. But meanwhile, we talked a lot last week about all the people Patel has fired. New York Times has a fascinating story, interview with two of those agents who were fired by Patel. One is Chris Meyer, and the other is Walt Giardino. Chris Meyer was the pilot. Patel ordered Brian Driscoll to fire him. Driscoll said there's no reason, there's no cause to fire him. And Patel said he was under a lot of pressure, and anybody who worked on the cases against the president was going to get removed. Meyer says in an on-the-record interview that he didn't even work on cases involving Donald Trump. It was bum information that apparently came from a former agent, this guy Kyle Serafin, who seems to be like a Laura Loomer type who posts on social media and people in the White House and DOJ quake. But the part that really grabbed me about this, I mean, both of these guys, Meyer and Giardino, longtime veteran agents, former U.S. military. Meyer flew over 350 hours as an Air Force pilot on three aircraft types in Afghanistan. Giardino, a 1999 graduate of the Naval Academy, commanded 100 Marines in combat during the 2003 invasion of Iraq, participating in firefights and following up with the 2011 deployment with the FBI in support of the military to Afghanistan. I mean, these are guys who have served their country for decades, and to be treated as shabbily as this, to be fired by ordered by the director because of political reasons. I mean, what message does that send?
Well, one message is that we have loyalty only to ourselves and those who are willing to profess loyalty in the way we want loyalty. But another, you know, piece of this is the shifting narrative about the need for evidence. Do we need evidence in order to say, like when he says, I didn't have anything to do with these things, when Meyer says this, where's the evidence? Who's, and is there a need to have evidence, and what kind of evidence? And sort of that's being pushed to the wayside as if that's just not as important as it was once. And I don't think this is the only place we're seeing that. So,
yes, evidence free. Before we get to our great guests, Karen, you wanted to bring something else up about a matter we have discussed.
Yes, and it's also about evidence. This was my lead in with the evidence, which is that, you know, the Trump administration has announced that they have just targeted their third Venezuelan boat for carrying drugs in this sort of series of attacks against Trinidad and Aragua for whether it's trafficking drugs, but they're also accused more generally of trafficking persons and many other things, violent confrontations, etc., extortion, etc. But the real issue here is, under what authority did the president say that these attacks could be launched? Traditionally, when there's kind of drug interdiction, it's done as a law enforcement issue. These are criminal matters. This was handled as a military matter. It was a military strike. They were military strikes. And so the question is, what's happening to this line between criminality and war? And where are we going with this? And the other question is, you know, to what are the authorities that the government is going to be relying on? They're sort of going back and forth. There's been some suggestion of using the 2001 AUMF because it because of the designation of Tren de Aragua as a terrorist organization, a foreign terrorist organization.
By the way, on its face, the AUMF authorization to use military force was passed after 9/11 that authorized the U.S. military to go after those who did the 9/11 attacks and people associated with it. We have strayed far away from that over the years, but this takes things onto a whole new level if you're going to encompass a Venezuelan gang as somehow part of the 9/11 network. It's just preposterous.
Correct. And what they're relying on is the fact that it talks about terrorism, but the beginning of the 2000 AUMF distinctly locates it within those who supported, harbored, helped, etc., provided material support for, etc., for Al-Qaeda and for the attacks. And what's happened under prior presidents is to use that AUMF to attack a whole host of countries that are tangentially, if in any way, associated with Al-Qaeda, but are in the terrorist network of, jihadist terrorist groups.
Yeah, but when we launch drone strikes against Al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen, at least there was the they were Al-Qaeda or they were associated with Al-Qaeda. We even then stretched it to include ISIS because they're bad terrorists and they're Islamists. So therefore, you can maybe make some connection. But, Tren de Aragua, you're way off.
This has been a vulnerability that has been left on the table by Congress all too long. No president has been willing to really take the lead in trying to get the 2001 AUMF sunsetted. And now we see, if they decide to rely on that, just how dangerous it's been to let it just lie there.
All good questions, but we've got a lot of questions for our two excellent guests. These are the two British journalists who uncovered some amazing information relevant to the 9/11 attacks themselves and how a Saudi suspect, who British cops very much believed was part of the 9/11 conspiracy, was let go. We're going to talk to them after this break. Okay, we are now joined by Amardeep Bassi and Liz Harris, the authors of a new bombshell story in the Sunday Times of London, as well as a three-part series in the Times The Story podcast. The headline, Revealed After 24 Years, How UK Was Forced to Free 9/11 Plotter. So, Liz and Amardeep, welcome to Spy Talk, and congratulations on your big scoop.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Yeah. So there's so much to dig into here. Karen and I were just at the Soufan Center Global Summit on Terrorism last week on the anniversary of 9/11. And your story and the issues that it raises were front and center at this conference. And there was a lot of talk, including from John Miller, former communications director of the FBI, a former journalist who said he wrote the first book about the 9/11 plot. It was called The Cell. And it had stood up pretty well until the last year or so, when we've learned so much more about the 9/11 conspiracy. And he said, the story of 9/11 has to be rewritten. So let me just start out. Liz, you and I have been in touch over the past year. Tell us how you got onto this and what motivated you to want to go down this rabbit hole that has yielded so much.
Okay, so how I came to the story, really, I'm going to, defer to Amardeep here, because we met each other a couple of years ago, and a few months in, he told me this story about Omar al-Bayoumi, and that's really when I started getting interested in it and starting to research, submitting FOIs. So I'm going to pass over to Amardeep here, because his story of like how he came to it is kind of quite extraordinary.
Yeah, well, as Liz said, that was my chat-up line to get Liz, was telling about my Bayoumi story, and it seems to have worked, but that's by the by. So my interest came really when I was working as a journalist for a local paper in Birmingham, a paper called the Sunday Mercury. Now, Birmingham, if your listeners don't know, is sort of Britain's second city, located in the heart of the country, very multicultural city. It's often described as the most cosmopolitan city in Europe. I think something like 160 different nations call Birmingham their home. And it's got a very young and large Muslim community. So even pre-9/11, I was doing stories on Islamism, on jihad, on Al-Qaeda, mainly, as I said, because of these Birmingham links. So when 9/11 happened, I remember when the second plane went into the South Tower, I immediately assumed it was Al-Qaeda because of that simultaneous nature of the attacks. The same as what happened in the African embassy bombings, that coordinated simultaneous attack was a signature of Al-Qaeda. A week later, 10 days later, our local police force, West Midlands Police, put out a press release basically telling journalists that we've made an arrest today in Birmingham of a man in connection with 9/11. So you can imagine my ears pricked up thinking, 9/11 connection to Birmingham? I know all roads lead to Birmingham, but even this road. So, and when it became clear he was being accused of, you know, participating in the 9/11 attacks, not just some peripheral player, that obviously piqued my interest even more. So, as is the protocol here, West Midlands Police don't give you the exact address. They just say in Birmingham. And us journalists, you know, work out ourselves from contacts or whatever, where to go. So all the journalists ended up at one address, an address called 67 Highgate Street, where Bayoumi had lived with his family in the shadow of the main central mosque. And all the journalists had gathered out there, including me. I had some contacts in the Muslim community who told me that actually this guy they've arrested, he had moved into another place just a few days earlier. And they gave me that address. So I went over to this address. It was called 34 Dymock Street, about a 10-minute walk from Highgate Street. And when I got there, I was pleased to see that there was no other press there. There was some movement there. I mean, it wasn't cordoned off or anything, but there was clearly some police activity. So as I started walking up to the front door, I was surprised when, I don't know whether he'd seen me or it was just a coincidence, a tall, quite imposing American gentleman kind of came out the door, literally bumped into me and sort of said, "Oh, who are you?" And I'm thinking, obviously, well, who are you with this broad American accent? Having a good guess that you're probably from some American agency and that there's something interesting going on here. And without going into too much detail, he kind of led me up the path, the literal garden path, away from the property, which made me again think there's something going on in there that, you know.
Did you get his name? Or what agency he worked for?
He worked for an American investigative agency. I think he wore several hats, shall we say. But I mean, this person, we ended up having a very fruitful relationship that lasted a lot of years. Unfortunately, he fell ill a few years ago, and has been, you know, kind of a recluse, shall we say. Hasn't really been in contact. So obviously that piqued my interest that much more.
So let me ask you, just cutting to the chase, did you write about this suspect, this Saudi suspect, Omar al-Bayoumi, at the time in September 2001?
Yeah, obviously beyond reporting the fact that he's been arrested, I then, and again, we're talking, this is the early days of the internet and Google and all that, but I was quite well versed in Google and searches by then. And I found that a reporter called Kelly Thornton, I think her name was, at the San Diego Tribune, had been writing a lot about al-Bayoumi and his relationship with the hijackers, Midara and Hazmi, in San Diego. So I would call her up. She would tell me stuff that's going on to do with Bayoumi in San Diego. I would print it in Birmingham. But the bottom line is he was released after a week. So I, just like many other journalists, thought, well, is he just another innocent Muslim who's been caught up in that initial dragnet after 9/11, when a lot of innocent Muslims were picked up and eventually found that there was no charge to answer? So, you know, when he was released, I thought, well, obviously they know what they're doing. There probably wasn't anything to it. But as these reports from Kelly started filtering through about the San Diego connection, it became more and more kind of, well, why did they let him go when there's all this evidence seemingly in San Diego? And plus, in the UK, there was lots of other interesting stuff going on. In my patch in Birmingham, all kinds of gun and gang wars. I myself ended up going to Afghanistan, you know, a couple of months after Fayumi's arrest. So I was distracted in that immediate aftermath. But Fayumi was a name that never left.
Right. A couple of thoughts on this. First is that Fayumi had not escaped media attention in the days after 9/11. There were stories about the extraordinary help that he provided the hijackers, meeting them in L.A., helping them settle in San Diego, finding them an apartment, loaning them money, introducing them to people in the Islamic community. But what you guys have done is you went back to the events of September 2001, tracked down one of the two cops who are interrogating Fayumi, and he had a hell of a lot to say about the decision to let this guy go. Liz, you want to tell us a little about how you found him in the first place and got him to talk so openly about what now looks like one of the biggest screw-ups in the 9/11 investigation?
Yeah, so for the past year or so, myself and Amadeep had been trying to locate police that worked on the investigation, whether they were police involved in the search, whether they were police involved in the interrogation of Fayumi. We were both reaching out to our contacts and, yeah, getting drawn here or there, but not getting to, you know, what we were looking for. And it was really when we obtained the transcripts that we obviously then knew the names of both officers.
Now, these are the transcripts of the interrogation of Fayumi by British police in the days after 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. The audio and the transcripts.
How did you get the transcripts?
These are filed on the docket for the 9/11 case. So they're unsealed.
The lawsuit filed in New York by the families of 9/11 victims against the Saudi government for complicity in the 9/11 attacks.
Yep.
And they got filed. Those transcripts got filed. When did they get filed?
August 2022.
August 2022. And nobody had noticed them before?
They are, as you probably know, Michael, there is a mountain of documents that have been lodged in this case, like literally a mountain,
thousands
and thousands of pages. And I dare any journalist to try and find them on their own. They are so buried that it would take, you know, you would really need to know your way around PACER for a start, the court service that you can access these public documents. But basically, yeah, they took some finding. They're not marked as in, here are the audio and the transcripts. Even though there's 11 hours of audio and nearly 1,000 pages of transcript, they are so well buried that you need someone to tell you where to look, basically.
So we got the name of the two officers from the transcripts, but they're very common names. You know, you'll know from the story, Ian Dean and David Campbell. I mean, there are thousands of people with this name in the UK. So we used our, you know, best OSINT skills, looking to kind of try and track them down using the various journalist tricks of the trade. We went to one house of Ian Dean, turned out to be the wrong Ian Dean. There's loads of David Campbells out there. I mean, take your pick. And then one day I was back online on a social networking site, and I came across David Campbell again that I hadn't seen there before. I sent him a message and it turned out to be the David Campbell. He'd put himself momentarily on a social networking site because he was interested in being found. for reasons relating to this case.
Really? Had he been following the New York case, the developments in the New York case, and knew this was still a live issue?
That's the impression we got.
When I contacted him, he sent me his number. I phoned him up and, you know, I was saying, you know, sorry for phoning you out of the blue, you know, I was still wondering if he was the right person. And his words to me were the words that probably every journalist dreams of hearing in their career. He said, "To be honest with you, I'm not surprised. I've been expecting this phone call. I've been waiting for it for the last 23 and a half years. I've been waiting for this call. Wow. The case stunk and I would like to tell my story."
Wow.
It was an incredible moment.
I can only imagine, and there's so much we want to dig into, but just summarize very quickly the gist of what he had to say.
Okay, so Dave thought the whole thing stunk. I mean, he believes that they were not given they weren't given what they needed to conduct the investigation thoroughly. He felt like that they were operating in the dark at the time, although having, you know, read those transcripts several times, I think they did the best that they could on the basis of the information that they had, you know, particularly grilling him about the guarantor question, about his finances, you know, about the party, about these guys that he'd met. And I think their names were Nawaf and Khalid. And, you know, I think they did the best that they could. At the end of that week, you know, what was really powerful was that at the end of that week, him and the other detective were convinced that Bayoumi had a case to answer, and that he should go before court to answer it. They had a conference call with the Department of Justice.
Before we get to the conference call, we actually, and this is extraordinary, you have gotten the tapes of that interrogation of Bayoumi by these two British cops. And just remember, Bayoumi is arrested by British police at the FBI's request after 9/11. He's being held in custody. They are interrogating him. He's insisting on his innocence, that all the help he provided to the hijackers, the apartment, the loan, the money, the setting them up, the meeting, he claimed by chance at the LA restaurant, was all innocent. He had no idea who they were, what they were up to. And the cops don't buy it. We've got a couple of clips from that interrogation.
"We believe that you're being funded and you're funding people for terrorist activities."
"No."
"Are you sure?"
No.
"You don't?
No.
Think about your answers very carefully, your lord. So there's two conclusions here. One, that you're a very unlucky man and you have been involved in this unfortunate conspiracy that's gone on. Or the other is that you're a guilty man and you are responsible for killing some 7,000 people."
"I'm honest man, and I don't want, and I have also, I care about my family. The truth will appear one day."
"Well, yeah. There is only one version of the truth, or more."
Liz, when you heard that, what went through your mind?
I mean, I think it's really the transcripts in full. I mean, that's just one incredible part of it. But I would say, knowing what we already know, I was glued. When I first listened to those recordings, I was just glued to them. They read like a thriller. Particularly, I go on about this, but the part when they're grilling him about being guarantor, you know, I almost had this, you know, it's almost uneasy reading and listening. You know, because you know, and they're having this dance around the subject, and you know that he's lying. And certainly like the culmination of that when you get to the end and the part that you've just, played, you just feel like things, when you hear that, things are not going well for Omar al-Bayoumi.
And yet, after, 10 days, he's let go and is a free man. He's released from custody by the British police. How did that happen?
Okay, so after 7 days, so Bayoumi had been held under the Terrorism Act of 2000. And according to that, he could be held for 7 days and then he has to be charged or released. So at the end of those 7 days, the officers, they leave Paddington Green Station. They took the tube over to Scotland Yard. It's about a half hour journey, in silence, because obviously they're not going to talk about the case. And then they went to this conference call, which would have been kind of early evening, because obviously the US is, 5 hours behind, or wherever the DOJ person was. And they're on the 15th floor of Scotland Yard, with a backdrop of London in front of them. And there's four officers in the room, two very senior officers, Alan Bunn and John Fry, and then the two detectives. They put in this call with a DOJ person whose identity we don't yet know. And Ian Dean and Dave Campbell spent an hour going through their findings of the last week. Both of them convinced that Bayoumi had a case to answer and this should be an extradition situation.
That he should be extradited to the United States to face charges for conspiracy in the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. But this is, this is a decision for the Department of Justice, because they are behind, the FBI is behind the warrant, behind Bayoumi's warrant. These are for offences committed on US soil. So they spent an hour outlining their case, at the end of which, fully expecting the DOJ representative to say, okay, I need to digest this, I'll come back to you with a decision. The decision was instant. And this was something Dave told me during our first call, something that they were both flabbergasted by. First of all, that the decision was instant, that the DOJ guy said, no, there's not enough. You don't have enough of him on him. Let him go. So they were astonished at that decision, but also at the speed, that the fact that it was instantaneous. And he told me that at the end of that call, he said there was just silence in the room. Silence. He said he can't speak for the two senior officers, but certainly for him and Ian Dean, it was a devastating result. And he just used those words, devastating, gobsmacked, flabbergasted, and never forgot about it.
Jaw dropping.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. And we're back. I want you to just bring into the conversation, just so listeners get it, the videos, right? The video of the Capitol and where this information comes into the story, because actually I think it's a very important part of the picture. Can you just talk about that a little bit and what it was?
Okay, so as we explained, the search, the physical search of the properties were all carried out by British officers, by West Midlands Police. The FBI didn't have jurisdiction to interview the suspect, to physically collect the evidence. You've got all these officers at this crime scene, literally bagging the evidence as they go along. And the important thing to remember here is that the British police, the Met police, were basically functionaries. They didn't have any powers of analysis. I mean, they didn't even know Bayoumi had lived in Britain. They didn't have any independent evidence about al-Bayoumi. They were totally in the hands of the FBI. And so it was the FBI that was analysing everything that came out of those houses, not the British police. The British police's job was to bag it, label it, and immediately hand it to a team of FBI analysts who were in London at the time, and they would analyse it in real time themselves. And so the interviewing officers, Campbell and Dean, the guys who were sat there interviewing Bayoumi, were totally reliant on what the FBI told them. So the evidence is coming out of the house. It's been given to the FBI. the FBI then decide whether to pass this information on to the interviewing officers. Now, as the search commences, stuff is being found, you know, very quickly. There's no real attempt to hide it. It's found in boxes in his garage, all scattered all around his house. And amongst this trove of evidence, as it's been described, was 80 videotapes. Now, Bayoumi was already known for being the camcorder man. People in San Diego and the local Muslim community had said, this man is always carrying his JVC camcorder and recording. If it moves, he'll record it. And so he, you know, he documented everything. In, you know, in this day of digital and encryption, this man was using good old-fashioned videotapes in a very analog fashion and collecting, you know, records of what he'd done. You've got phone numbers, you've got address books, you've got photos, he'd got people's business cards. And so a lot of stuff is coming out of the house. Now, one of the things that came out of the house, as I said, was these bags of videotapes. And one bag in particular, which was labeled exhibit number PSS-100, contained a number of videotapes. Now, we certainly know one videotape, the so-called welcoming party video of Al Bayoumi with 29 other men at the hijacker's apartment. Basically, it's been described as a welcoming party. Also in that bag, which was never, and it was never taken out of the bag, it was never shown to Bayoumi, was another video, which was labeled Washington Trip. I think the dates were late June to early July 1999. Now, the videotape contained footage that Bayoumi had taken. He's with two Saudi diplomats, like official Saudi diplomats, and they're in Washington, and they're filming around Capitol Hill. And on the face of it, it may look like a tourist video. There's shots of a fountain, shots of gardens and whatever. But between those shots are lingering shots of the security, shots of Capitol Hill, shots of the nearby airport, and a running commentary where Bayoumi is clearly addressing people living in a foreign country. You know, he starts off by saying, this is Omar al-Bayoumi reporting from the Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. You know, this was for the ears of a foreign audience. And he is, it's almost like a report. He's saying, this is the security, this is that. And then it takes a bit of a sinister turn where he pans the camera onto the Capitol building itself and talks about, this is where the decisions are made, the big decisions are made. And then he says, well, but Allah is the only one who can decide things. And then he uses a term where he talks about, they call our children terrorists, but this is where the real demons are, or words to that effect.
And he refers to the plan.
And he refers to the plan. So he pans the camera onto some security cars or by the car park, some big Lincoln type vehicles are clearly kind of security vehicles. And he says something along the lines of, you wanted to know this, you wanted to know this as part of the plan. And he doesn't elaborate on what this plan is, but, you know, we could have a good guess as to what that plan was and is. So this video, as I said, is in that bag that is wheeled into the interview room with Bayoumi there. But that videotape, Bayoumi certainly doesn't say, oh, by the way, you might want to take a look at this video I took of Washington. So he's not going to offer it up to the detectives, but it's in that bag. It doesn't get looked at. And it's that bag is wheeled out of that interview room and isn't seen. That video is not seen again for 23 years. Nobody sees that video.
So the cops did not see it who were interrogating him. And we don't even know if anybody at the FBI had looked through that video. They had seized 80 videos from his garage and home in Birmingham. This is... what, how long after the September 11th? What's the date that there of these interrogations?
So he's arrested on the 21st of September, 10 days, and then he's held for 7 days.
And held for 7 days. So this is late September of, and whether the FBI had even looked at it, we don't know. That leads to, I believe Karen has a very good question off of that.
Yeah, my question is, and you know, part of this is from what you've reported, part of it is just from things you've learned, but my question is, you know, how as you've reached out to U.S. officials and U.S. experts, how have they responded to the way you've told the story, which is basically that the FBI refused or just didn't turn over the evidence that was collected and pursued the case, and that they refused extradition. So can you just talk a little bit about the U.S. side of this, how the information was received, and in particular, in these recent times, how they've responded to the exposure of this evidence?
Well, the American authorities, the FBI, have played this whole case with a straight bat and have been consistent in saying nothing. We sent them a very detailed write-up reply. And we had a one sentence answer saying we cannot comment at this stage. It was very, it's quite an odd email actually. It was something like, "Hello, we can't say anything. Goodbye."
And this was in which administration? When is this that we're talking about?
So just recently, just as we were finishing off the investigation, getting right to reply from the Saudis, from the FBI.
I've gotten my own email responses from the FBI exactly along the same lines, but. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, the things we've been hearing is, clearly, in the days after 9/11, the FBI were deluged by leads and people telling them, "Look at this guy. Look at that guy. We found this guy's been carrying a painting of the Twin Towers," or all kinds of stuff was being bandied about. But as I keep saying, the plane diagram that was found at Bayoumi's house, with descent calculations and distance from the horizon and, all this kind of stuff. How much analysis does that need? I mean, I can tell you that looks dodgy. I don't, so you can't really say they didn't have enough time to analyze it, et cetera, et cetera. That should have set off alarm bells immediately.
So they had the airplane sketch. They didn't have the video. The cops did, but the cops had the airplane sketch?
No. So we know, again, this is documented, we know that by September the 22nd, the West Midlands police had found the diagram in an upstairs room on a shelf. And on that same day, they had passed it on to the FBI. And so the FBI had that diagram within 24 hours. The West Midlands police had bagged it. They had put a note on the outside of it, remarks. You have a little place on the actual bag itself where you can scribble notes. And it said something like, "This is significant. It has descent calculations."
Can you just elaborate on what the diagram was and how it's been interpreted of what it meant?
Okay, so the diagram is a very crude, kind of hand drawn in blue ink, diagram with a tiny image of a plane. It's very crude. So you've got this tiny little plane at the top, and then you've got these equations underneath, all kinds of numbers. But some of the stuff is very straightforward, and he's written in English. So he talks about written alongside the aeroplane is something about height in miles from the horizon, and then there's these kind of trajectory lines which seem to be pointing towards the ground. And so when it finally came to light, this diagram, the FBI obviously had it examined themselves. So did the plaintiff's lawyers, and pilots of big who've got a lot of experience, have said that this is the kind of calculations you'd need to calculate how to hit something on the ground, basically.
And you want to remind us what Bayoumi said when he was presented with this diagram and asked what it was about? Remember what he
said? So obviously Bayoumi did not answer any questions about it in that initial interview with the British police, because the British police hadn't been handed it by the FBI. So the first and only time he's ever been questioned about it was in a deposition he gave to the plaintiff's family in June 2021. So he did this by Zoom. He's in Riyadh. And he's directly asked, "So this plane diagram found in your house, what's this equation about?" And he says something like, "It's an equation, just like any other equation." And it's like, "You what?" "It's just an equation like any other equation." He's obviously pressed on it. "Now, what is this stuff about height from the horizon, distance from whatever?" And then he talks about, "Well, I'm a person who likes to read. I'm really interested in things. It might have been an old high school equation that somehow come back to my head 25 years later, and I'm now trying to solve it." And then he kind of, I think he realized that that's not going to cut the mustard, so I better say something else. So then he says something like, well, it's just a way of calculating distance. And then he says something like, well, you know, from Washington to Seattle. And then out of nowhere, he ends by saying, well, to Baltimore. And that's the end of his explanation. Hmm. Now, what's quite telling is, until he had said that directly and first, you know, first time he's actually said in his own words, yes, I drew this, this is the reason why. The plaintiffs, his lawyers, had tried to speak for him and had told the judge at an earlier hearing that these were equations that his son, who would have been about 14 at the time, these are equations that his high school son is, you know, some kind of homework that his son was looking at. And the judge actually said, why are you putting words in Mr. Bayoumi's mouth? He's clearly told us that he drew them. So stop going on about his son. But yeah, that was very surreal, where he's just talking, oh, these were just idle doodles I'm doing. But another very telling thing was, obviously the plaintiffs had them analyzed by a pilot called Barry Schiff. And they also did, you know, further analysis. And they finally worked out that some of the numbers basically were coincided with the coordinates of what's known as kind of navigational beacons or navigational waypoints on the eastern sideboard of the USA. Now, I'm no expert on these, but there's some kind of navigational aid for pilots who might have lost electronic aids and want to land or want to know, you know, want to get their bearings right again. Now, they are located all over the country. I think they're public knowledge. You can find out where these beacons are. But what's really telling is these beacons, so, you know, the plaintiff's lawyers worked out, well, hang on, these numbers coordinate with the location of these beacons on the eastern sideboard. Again, what was, you know, kind of really interesting about it as well is, a year after 9/11, Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden, through their media arm, As-Sahaba, I think they're called, released a video practically on September the 11th, 2002, where for the first time they kind of admitted it was us. And they showed a lot of footage of the preparations that they'd been doing. There's footage of the hijackers in Afghan training camps. And there's one image, quite a fleeting image, where you've got some of the hijackers in Afghanistan pre-9/11 planning the attack. And you have a map in the background of the America, and clearly marked out on that map are where the navigational aids on the eastern sideboard of USA are.
So taking a step back here, about why all this is so significant. The suspicion here is not that Bayoumi was just one more player in the 9/11 conspiracy, that he was a lone operator assisting the conspirators, but that he was the organizer of an entire support network, a Saudi support network for the hijackers in the United States in planning for the 9/11 operation. And underlying that are phone records showing while he was helping the hijackers, he was repeatedly in contact with others, the Imam Fahd Thumairi, the Imam of the Saudi-funded mosque in Los Angeles. He meets with Thumairi just before he meets with the hijackers. There's something like 90 phone calls he makes to the Saudi embassy at crucial times when he's providing this assistance to the hijackers, including 30 to the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, which is filled with jihadists, Islamists. So what is the... I guess, based on that, what is the larger significance of this, especially in that New York case that the families have brought against the Saudi government itself?
I suppose the largest significance here is, you know, obviously after 9/11, everyone wants to know who did it. And almost immediately, the Bush administration is talking about going after Afghanistan, because that's where Bin Laden is. Again, the Bush administration kind of makes it clear that they don't believe that there was any state involvement in this, you know, maybe the Afghan state. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the premise of this war was that Al-Qaeda has done it. We need to get Al-Qaeda. We need to destroy Al-Qaeda. Once we've killed bin Laden and destroyed Al-Qaeda, case closed. Now, all these revelations seem to show that actually the Americans knew within 24 hours that there is a strong Saudi link here. You know, if they'd just looked at that diagram, the Capitol Hill video, if they'd looked at all that evidence that came out of that house, you know, 14 days after 9/11, all the stuff that came out of Buyumi's Birmingham property pretty much showed you the whole Saudi sport network, you know, in chronological order, names, numbers, when he contacted them, why he contacted them, where he contacted them. And yet all of that wholesale evidence seems to have never been acted on. And so the question is, you know, was the war on terror based on a mistake? Or more seriously, was it based on a cover-up? Was it based on a deliberate, you know, at the end of the day, thousands, if not millions of people were killed and maimed and injured in the war on terror. We went after Afghanistan. We went after Iraq. You know, thousands of British, American and other soldiers also died. And if I was the parents of some of those soldiers or any of those people who died, I'd be thinking, well, okay, there was a war on terror, but were we fighting it in the right place? You know, that's the thing I take from this really is all those lives taken when really you had evidence that another country, albeit what you called an ally or ally at the time, that they had a lot more questions to answer. And those questions never seem to have been asked. If anything, those questions seem to have been tucked away and you know, the Saudis shielded from any scrutiny.
Am I correct in thinking that since you're reporting, this recent reporting, the British government is taking some interest in this and pursuing this? Can you talk a little bit about what's happening?
Yeah, so our story went out in the Sunday Times, obviously on a Sunday. On the Monday morning, quite a kind of very experienced MP, David Davis, asked what's called an urgent question in the House of Commons, the House of Parliament. And the urgent question basically was talking about our story in the Sunday Times. The questions were addressed to the security minister, somebody called Dan Jarvis. And basically David Davis.
And actually, Amardeep, we're going to play just two brief clips from the urgent question.
I call Sir David Davis.
To ask the Minister of State for the Home Department if he'll make a statement on the 2001 arrest of Saudi national Omar al-Bayoumi and the failure to extradite Mr. al-Bayoumi for his alleged involvement in the September 11th terror attacks.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. The attacks on 9/11 were an appalling assault on freedom.
A full investigation by the Intelligence and Security Committee is needed, investigating why the FBI clearly avoided extraditing Mr. al-Bayoumi, and also exactly what the involvement of the Saudi government was, in particular its Ministry of Islamic Affairs and its Secret Service. It's nearly 25 years, as the Minister said, since 9/11. We've extradited in that time many innocent people to America, but we've failed to extradite someone who deserved to be sent over there. We need to get to the bottom of this, in part because we must learn the lessons of this so we don't see this terrible atrocity happen again.
Yeah. So it seems very likely now that the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee will conduct a full hearing into, well, what happened? You know, why did we let this man go? Again, it's quite telling that when we spoke to, or the Sunday Times spoke to the Holmes, or who was Jack Straw, who was the Foreign Secretary of the UK at the time, David Brunkett, who was the Home Secretary at the time, somebody called Sir Richard Dearlove, who was the head of MI6, our kind of CIA equivalent. All three of them said, we know nothing about this. This guy wasn't flagged up to us, which sounds incredible that they didn't know.
I have to say, I find the interest in the British government in finding out what happened here and having an open discussion in the House of Commons about it remarkable, because in the United States, there has been absolutely nothing
Blumenthal and Cornyn have presented a letter to the FBI asking them for information, given what's come to light. So, but that's the extent of it.
That's the extent of it. Blumenthal spoke about this at the Sufan Center Global Summit last week, but we've heard nothing from the FBI, nothing from the Trump administration, nothing from the Justice Department, and nothing from Congress. We just had this week on Wednesday, Kash Patel, the director of the FBI, testified before 4 hours before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Nothing. And granted, there were a lot of questions to ask the FBI director right now, including about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, his handling of that, the firings at the FBI that Patel has orchestrated, but not a single question about the biggest terrorist attack in the United States ever, and new information that you folks have brought to light that raises serious questions about whether we know the full story about what was behind those attacks. And, you know, the British government's taking it seriously. Nothing from the United States government so far, except for that letter by Senator Cornyn and Senator Blumenthal.
I mean, you got to remember, at the end of the day, Ayumi was arrested on UK soil using UK legislation. And, you know, what if they'd released him, you know, after the 7 days, and he panics and he immediately plants a bomb somewhere? What were the British going to say? Oh, well, the FBI told us to let him go.
Yeah.
You know, he was a danger to Britain.
Right.
Potentially.
So I want to just ask two questions, which I think are might be of interest. One is, where are the originals of the materials that were found in Bayoumi's place after 9/11? That's the first question.
Okay, so Bayoumi was released after the week of interviewing on the say-so of the Department of Justice. His passport is taken off him. He's released, and he carries on studying, goes back to Birmingham, and he's told to report back to Paddington Green Police Station on May the 2nd, 2002. So a good, you know, 6 months plus after his release. We're not sure what he's been doing in those 6 months. We are making inquiries and finding things out. But on May the 2nd, 2002, he reports back to Paddington Green, and he's basically handed all the original evidence back, like everything. The videotapes, the handwritten diagram, which is, we found out was called item number 32, that was passed to him. He's got it all. And obviously, he takes it back to Saudi Arabia with him. So he's always had the originals. He's had all the videotapes given back, the handwritten notebook.
But there are copies.
You know, the lot.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking, by the way, for production in a court, you usually need to have the original, not a copy, certainly in a criminal trial. I don't know what the standards will be in the civil case, but if the FBI were ever going to try and prosecute Bayoumi, they would have needed those originals. And the fact that they gave the originals implicating a terror suspect in an act of mass terrorism back to the terror suspect seems, I think, a lot of FBI agents will find mind-boggling.
I mean, fortunately, the Met Police's protocol in any of cases like this was to make several copies, not just two. So in total, they made seven copies. And they weren't just like photographs. These were forensic copies of everything. And, you know, they kept all one copy, obviously, went to the FBI. Other copies, we can't really say where they went to, but other copies were, you know, seven in total. And one was certainly sent, given to the FBI via their legal attaché in London. And so, yeah, these copies, we only ever had the copies.
And my second question is, where is Bayoumi now?
So certainly in June 2021, when he was giving the deposition to the plaintiff's lawyers, he was doing that from Riyadh. So we presume he's in his late 60s now, probably retired. The last we know was somewhere in Riyadh.
One last question to wrap up here. You know, the FBI doesn't object. The Justice Department doesn't object and says, let the guy go. He goes back. The 9/11 Commission
does a full investigation of everything that happened on 9/11, highly publicized hearings, massive report that we all pored over, and it essentially dismisses all this. It says Bayoumi seems no evidence that he has Islamic radical ties or sympathies. He comes across as as essentially an innocent man, and there's no evidence of Saudi involvement in the terror attacks at all. So the 9/11 Commission dismisses any idea that the Saudis may have played any role. But there are people in the FBI who don't buy it, who are not convinced. And quietly, no public announcement, in 2007, they launch Operation Encore, which is a full investigation of the Saudi role in 9/11. And it's not until, 4 or 5 years later, that the video, the smoking gun casing video that Bayoumi made, is discovered in some warehouse in at the FBI, and leading to whole new avenues of inquiry. And I believe the Brits, the cops, knew nothing about Operation Encore. Am I right about that, Liz?
Actually, as I understand it, it was not the casing video didn't surface until, was it last year?
Yeah, 2024.
Okay, so just to go back. Yeah, so it was actually in 2012 that an evidence technician clearing out a police storeroom, an FBI storeroom in Washington, chanced upon a box of stuff marked Omar al-Bayoumi, and having a look through, made the just astonishing discovery of this photocopy of the plane diagram. And that's when this came to light, and this evidence technician called the Operation Encore officers, knowing that they were working on this secret investigation. And that's when, that was the first time it's not the first time that the FBI saw the plane diagram, but it's when Operation Encore, who had never bought the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission, that's when they discovered this. Now, the 9/11 Commission did not have that plane diagram. They had a truncated version of the party video, not the full version. They had a version that was found at the Al-Madinah Mosque in San Diego, not the versions that came out of that evidence bag, PS-100, from Bayoumi's house. They also did not have the casing video, which came to light only last year. Now, Dave Campbell, when he saw, because then it was years later, because obviously that was classified information. The plane diagram did not surface into the public domain until the declassification from Executive Order 140.040 in 2021. Now, Dave Campbell told me, when he saw that on a news report, he felt sick, sick and frustrated and horrified for the families of 9/11 victims. Likewise, when he became aware, very recently, of the casing video, and he said, if he'd have been aware of those two pieces of evidence when he was questioning Bayoumi, in his own words, he said, I'd have taken him to the cleaners on the basis of that. And he also said to me, nobody can tell me. That's a reconnaissance video, and I say this on the basis of years of investigative experience as a counterterror officer, and no one can tell me different.
Well, very powerful stuff. I want to thank you both for your groundbreaking work on a story that some of us have covered off and on for more than two decades. And, we're often skeptical that we're going to learn something new and significant about events that have been so well investigated over the years. But you guys did it. So congrats. And I hope to keep tabs on everything you do from here, especially. Will there be follow-ups for both of you?
There will be a lot of follow-ups. I mean, as you can imagine, even though the article in the Sunday Times is about 4,500 words long, there are at least another 14,500 words that didn't make it into that piece. Just one nuanced point I wanted to make, Michael. And also, I just wanted to say, you know, you're congratulating us. We kind of built on your reports and other journalist reports. You know, this didn't come in a vacuum. So we're really thankful for you, Michael, for helping us and using some of your past articles as basis for ours. Just one point I wanted to make about, did the FBI really see that diagram in that week while Bayoumi was being interviewed? Like I said, it was marked as Category 1. It was passed to them urgently. They must have been blind if they didn't see it. But one clue in the interrogation seems to show that they did see that diagram, because all of a sudden, on about day 3 of the interrogation, you hear Campbell, out of nowhere, suddenly ask Bayoumi, well, you work for the Saudi Civil Aviation Authority. Does that mean you can fly? And he kind of said, no, I'm, you know, my duties are more logistics and people's wages and whatever. And they kind of push him a little bit, but not a lot. They just kind of leave it. Now, that seems to suggest to me that the FBI has seen that plane diagram. They want to feel the ground with him and say, well, ask him without telling the British officers, look, we found this plane diagram. They're testing the waters with Bayoumi by saying, well, can you fly? Now, when he says no, if the officers had seen the diagram, that would have been the ideal time to say, well, you say you don't know how to fly. Well, what the hell are you doing with this diagram in your own handwriting if you don't know anything about flying? So that seems to, you know, this is just my speculation, that one, you know, question that seems a bit left field and doesn't fit in with the others, can you fly, seems to suggest that the FBI have seen that diagram and now they want to test the waters. And they've said to the British officers, just ask him if he can fly, without saying, well, the reason we're asking is because we found this diagram. And if he says he can't, put this diagram under his nose and say, well, what's this about then? So I thought that was very
true. Yeah, well, as we have reported, and other news organizations have reported, the federal judge in New York has given a green light for this case to proceed, rejecting the motion by the Saudi lawyers to dismiss the case. So there will be, hopefully, new opportunities in that court case for these questions to get answered. Liz and Amardeep, thanks again for all your great work.
Yeah, just fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and Molly Hawkins, and expertly edited by Molly for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.